Emperors of Rome is a listener-supported podcast. To find out more, help keep us on air, and get some fairly cool perks, go to patreon.com/Rome Podcast. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome. I'm your host Matt Smith, and with me today is Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCLV, Augusti Retirement. In 305 CE, a carefully staged transition took place. The emperors Diocletian and Maximian retired, handing power to a new generation of rulers. Exactly how it happened is still debated, but the act itself was unprecedented in the long history of the Roman Empire. Here's Kaelin Davenport. In the year 303, something happens in the Roman Empire that I'm not sure how long it's been since they've had the opportunity to celebrate like this for quite a long time. Diocletian reaches this 20th year of his reign, which is an excuse for both a hanging and a party, or perhaps a bit of both.
I know, it's quite miraculous, isn't it? You know, 20 years. Even Septimius Severus didn't make it to 20 years.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, he died in 211. So, you know, you think about how far back you have to go to a 20-year reign. You're probably looking at, Marcus Aurelius didn't do 20 years either. He was 161 to 180. You're looking back to Antoninus Pius.
Really?
I think so.
Wow. You'd be right. It would be that far back because, you know, Trajan, Hadrian, yep. And then just disaster of the third century.
For 5 years, make it 5 years, you've won the lotto. Yeah, no, it's really, you know, quite an achievement, especially because, as we've been saying, you know, Diocletian doesn't have an unchallenged reign. There are threats internally and externally which could have destabilized him, but he's made it to his Wiccanalia, his 20th year anniversary.
So Rome goes and finds an old textbook about the ceremonies that are meant to happen during this sort of celebration,
yes.
Blows off all the dust, gets rid of a few random spiders, cracks it open and goes, okay, so what's meant to happen for a 20th year celebration? What happens? How does Rome go about celebrating this?
Rather remarkably, they go to Rome, which of course, you know, itself is remarkable. Diocletian and Maximian are present in Rome. It seems that Constantius and Galerius are not. Indeed, the Emperor Galerius lives and dies without ever entering Rome, we're later told by Lactantius. Two of the emperors are there in person. There's a triumphal parade, particularly to celebrate the victory over the Persians. But we also know the Roman Forum has been remodeled to glorify the Tetrarchic emperors. So on the imperial rostra, which is like now a flat rectangular box which stands next to the Arch of Septimius Severus, there were five statues erected there of the four tetrarchs and Jupiter in the middle. And there were also a number of other columns erected throughout the forum. And those are the sort of the large brick rectangular bases that you can see today in the large central grassy area. And several of them have friezes that still survive, showing sacrificial scenes being performed by the senators who are wearing late Roman garb. So you know, it's quite an event. And, you know, the Tetrarchs, even though they're so rarely in Rome, manage to at least imprint themselves on the city. And no doubt Diocletian is also supervising the final stages of the construction of the baths in his name.
Yeah, that's right, because that had been going on around that time as well. Although I seem to remember you saying they had a lot more to do with Maximian.
That's right. So Maximian started it when he returned to Italy from Africa. But of course, it was dedicated in the name of all the emperors. And Diocletian's the senior one, so that's why we know it is named after him.
Do we get a sense of what he was thinking, how reflective he was being during this time? I mean, we can kind of have a bit of a guess about the things that are going through his mind. But as we've said, it's quite an achievement to reach 20 years of your reign, especially in the climate that the Roman Empire has at the time. But this is a man who is getting on in his years and also doesn't have a related heir that he can pass it on to. I mean, I know he's got the other tetrarchs that he's established, but what could be going through his head to set up in the future?
Yeah, so here we really have to turn to some later evidence, and we're back in the world of the Western panegyrics, which are delivered in honour of various members of the Imperial College. So two later speeches, one delivered in 307, the other delivered in 310, tell us that Diocletian and Maximian made a pact when they were in Rome. And this pact is that they would retire, they would set down their mantle of office and then be succeeded by the Caesars, with the understanding that two new Caesars would then be appointed. So the Imperial College would continue. And so in Panegyrici Latini 7, this is from 307, which is delivered in honour of Maximian and Constantine. As to why it's delivered in both their honour, you'll have to wait for a future episode because of all the exciting machinations that happen. The orator here says that the retirement was, and I quote, a plan long since resolved upon, in fact, by you both, and by fraternal piety, so that in the sharing of some deed you would not desert a man whom you have always had as a partner for the whole of your life and in the most important affairs. And then another speech delivered in honour of Constantine himself a few years later in 310, this is Panegyrici Latini 6:15.6, this is that Maximian and Diocletian actually swore an oath to each other in the temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus on the Capitoline Hill that they would both retire together, thus making way for their Caesars, Constantius and Galerius.
I can see that this would be an excellent time for that conversation to happen. In retrospect, I wonder how one-sided that conversation was.
Yes. So, I mean, they so rarely met Diocletian and Maximian in person. Of course, they could correspond by letter. The implication from other historical sources like Eutropius, Aurelius Victor, etc., is that Maximian was an unwilling partner in this plan and that the motivation actually came from Diocletian himself.
How did the rest of the celebrations unfold then?
We don't really have a full account of exactly what happened. I mean, we do have Lactantius' account, and of course he is not very positive about Diocletian because he is a persecutor, and of course Lactantius is a Christian. So he sort of paints this as a rather unfortunate visit. He says in 17.2, after the festival had been celebrated, he was unable to endure the outspokenness of the people of Rome, and impatient and sick in mind, he rushed out of the city just as the 1st of January was impending, the day on which his ninth consulship was to be bestowed upon him. So there's this idea that in Rome, emperors, you know, they have to put up with the license, the freedom of speech from the crowd. You know, this is their ancestral right going back from the Republic, you know, mocking politicians and then, you know, mocking Augustus and to the Junior Claudians with scurrilous poems and ditties, etc. And, you know, Diocletian's not used to this. It's a very different time. And so he's just not happy at all and, you know, rushes out in a bit of a fit of pique.
Considering how little time he spent in Rome and how much he seemed to be a man who was more used to the battlefield, I can kind of imagine him getting impatient with pageantry and wanting to leave. I can understand that.
Also, he's not familiar with the place, you know. He doesn't spend time in Italy, you know. Nicomedia is, you know, the city that's sort of built to be his capital where he's at home. So, you know, he leaves Rome, he rushes out, he actually assumes his consulship in North Italy in Ravenna. He's not feeling well. It's said by Lactantius, you know, that it's the middle of winter, you know, there's cold, there's rain. He becomes quite ill. He does go to the Danube, where it's suggested there may have been a campaign or at least settlement of the Carpi in Roman territory. But he's not well, even when he leaves that summer to go back to Nicomedia. He's very ill.
So when you've got an emperor who's ruled for 20 years and is suddenly getting ill all the time, is this the sort of thing that is becoming visible to the Roman people? I mean, it must have been a concern that this is happening.
He's almost 60, you know, which is pretty good innings for the Roman world, especially for someone who is a soldier as well and actually leads his army from the battlefield. So, but yes, there's some real suspicion going on. So he does come out on the 20th of November of 304 to formally open the circus, the Hippodrome in Nicomedia. And then he doesn't appear. He doesn't appear again throughout the entire winter. In fact, not until the 1st of March the following year, 305, is he seen again. And so rumors begin to spread throughout the city that he is dead. And not only that he's dead, but that his passing has been covered up until Galerius should arrive on the scene and take control of the troops, because, you know, you don't want the news that the emperor is dead to get out early. And, you know, that could be an opportunity for armed revolt. And so there's this suspicion that consumes all of Nicomedia, which, you know, I think we can believe, because Lactantius lived there, that Diocletian was dead. Rumors only start because people believe in them, because the situation is plausible. They show people's preconceptions, their beliefs, their prejudices. And, you know, in a world in which the health of the Roman Empire is so often judged by the health of the emperor and then his vitality and his appearance at public events, if he's not seen for a long time, then people are going to get very suspicious.
And that's what's happening in this case then.
Exactly. It's very plausible. And discussed in my forthcoming book, Behind Caesar's Back, Rumour, Gossip and the Making of the Roman Emperors, out from Yale University Press on the 30th of March in Australia.
That was smoothly done. I won't even edit that out.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Out now, the UK and the US. In all fairness, I do talk about it in the book.
So what is the other side of these rumours then? If you have an emperor who is sick, at the very least, you are going to want to have firm succession plans in place.
Exactly. And, you know, Diocletian clearly isn't well. So we can believe one story is that, you know, he's already agreed with Maximian that they're going to retire and let the Caesars step up. And that's, you know, what appears in the panegyrics. But we also have a quite different story in Lactantius. And this is some of Lactantius's best writing. I mean, its historical veracity is up for debate, but it is amazing stuff. So Galerius comes to the palace. He arrives at Nicomedia and, you know, he wants there to basically force Diocletian to resign. Lactantius talks about Diocletian being mentally unhinged. Galerius appears to essentially try to push him over the edge. No, he initially says, this is chapter 18 of On the Deaths of the Persecutors, that, you know, he says, oh, now you're getting on, you know, you're not as strong as they used to be. Oh, you ought to rest, you know, lay down the burden of office in this kind of way. And he says, you know, oh, Nerva did this, you know, when he, you know, handed over to Trajan, you know, omitting the fact that, of course, you know, there was really a coup by the Praetorian Guard and Nerva was forced in to this position. But, you know, Diocletian in this narrative is not giving in. He really pushes Diocletian in order for him to retire. And really, Galerius issues Diocletian with an ultimatum. Lactantius says, 18.6, if Diocletian refused to give way, Galerius went on, he would look to his own interests so as not to remain any longer the junior ruler at the bottom of the list. That's clearly a threat to sort of take power himself. Diocletian sort of sighs and said, let it be then if this is what you want.
Yeah, I mean, that gets to the brink of, you know, inciting a civil war, a threatening it of some sort.
And it really does fit with Lactantius' image, you know, as well, that we see in the kind of the persecution that, you know, Diocletian is, you know, mad, unhinged, and Galerius, you know, does what he can to try and push Diocletian over the edge by setting fire to the palace and blaming it on the household members who are Christians. etc. So this sort of fits in. I think the Western panegyric is the correct version that they decided. And the Maximian does seem to be the unwilling one, because we know from later events that he really wants to get back in the thick of things. I think, you know, it was a decision that Diocletian made, but Lactantius wants to push this agenda to denigrate the persecuting emperors.
Yeah. So this is going to be a very messy succession by the sounds of it. The rollover of this and the coordination of this and how it's going to unfold with so many people who have a stake in the game and different opinions. I mean, Galerius can make his demands of Diocletian all he wants, but the actual reality of it seems to be quite messy.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's also tied up with sort of bonds of marriage and adoption. So the idea is that Constantius and Galerius become Augusti, and, you know, Constantius would be the senior, the head of the Imperial College then. But then there is the choice of who the Caesar should be. Constantius and Maximian both have grown sons. Constantius' son Constantine has been serving in the East as a soldier with Diocletian. We talked about that in the Persian War episode. He's seen Babylon and Memphis, etc., in the service of the East. And Maxentius, who is the son of Maximian, we know very little about his life, probably served in the army, though it's not mentioned. But more to the point, actually, is that Maxentius, Maximian's son, is married to the daughter of Galerius, Valeria Maximilla. You know, this is someone who is innately bound in to the Imperial College. And so it is a complicated situation. Diocletian does seem to be playing his cards close to his chest, but, you know, there are hints in some of the Western panegyrics that they think that Maxentius is being prepared for the succession. Now, in Lactantius, Galerius dismisses them. Galerius doesn't want Constantine and Maxentius to become Caesars. Galerius says, Maxentius is not worthy of it. If he has been showing contempt for me while he is a private citizen, what will he do when he has imperial authority? So obviously he doesn't like the attitude of his son-in-law. And, you know, when Diocletian suggests, you know, Constantine's a popular young man, Galerius says, but in that case, I shall not be able to do what I want. We must appoint men who will be in my power. Fear me and do nothing but what I command.
Yeah, he's not coming off as the best person you want in the purple.
No, exactly, exactly. And it's completely true that Diocletian, he hasn't shown his hand. Constantine and Maxentius are, you know, part of the scene, but, you know, they're not on coins. They're not being publicly promoted in many ways that we have seen. You know, designated successors being done. The Caesars have, but, you know, there's no sort of publicly declared follow-up plan there. And so in Lactantius, Galerius, you know, suggests two other Caesars. The first suggestion is a man called Severus, to which Diocletian replies, "What? That drunken, intoxicated devotee of the dance who treats the day as night and the night as day?" Galerius replies, "He deserves it. He has been a loyal army commander. I have sent him already to Maximian to be invested in office by him." This is Flavius Valerius Severus, who we know very little about, apart from the fact that he is another man from the Danubian region, you know, worked his way up through the officer corps.
With loyalty to Galerius.
Exactly. Yeah. Which, to be fair, you know, these are the same principles of which Diocletian, you know, pointed Maximian, Constantius and Galerius in the first place. It wasn't that they were related. It's that, you know, that he thought he could trust them. There were men from the same background there. So there is the idea of that military brotherhood coming through again. And then the other Caesar is Maximinus Darza, who is also from the Danube and is Galerius's nephew.
So again, somebody with the loyalty to Galerius.
Exactly, and has that sort of family tie there. And Lactantius is very disparaging about him. You know, says that, you know, he's a former herdsman, and then suddenly he's a Caesar. He's had a long army career.
So Galerius sounds like he's going to get his own way here. and that his co-Augustus will be Constantius, and he can't get around that. But it also sounds like he's potentially setting up resistance and a civil war if he's not careful. This is the situation that I see the Tetrarchy was set up to avoid.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, more of a power-sharing structure than this is becoming.
Yeah, I mean, it could have gone the other way if Constantine was appointed Caesar to his father in the West. It just shows how messy it is, and that, you know, they have, you know, ties of marriage and adoption and other ties of relationship. They are bound up with it. Once the system is set up, it's never going to be pure merit. It's going to be quite complicated. We must remember this is Lactantius's version. I would be surprised if Diocletian was really the pushover that Lactantius portrays him to be.
Compliant tears is a phrase that I wouldn't really apply to Diocletian that Lactantius used.
Exactly.
So now we've got something that Rome has never gone through, the abdication and retirement of an emperor. Completely the opposite of blowing off an old textbook, getting the dust off it, creaking it open and seeing how to celebrate 20 years. How do you celebrate, commemorate, handle the handover, give you 2 weeks' notice? How does all of this work for an emperor?
Yes. So Diocletian, you know, always with a touch of theatrical, does plan to do it outside Nicomedia, you know, the same place where he himself was acclaimed, and he acclaimed Galerius as Caesar on the 1st of May. So there's going to be a ceremony there in front of all the troops, and presumably there's going to be an equivalent ceremony, which we never hear about, taking place at Milan on the same day. Now, Lactantius's narrative really focuses on how Constantine is being passed over here. Lactantius says, beginning of chapter 19, "The gaze of all was upon Constantine. No one had any doubt. The soldiers who were present, the military officers who had been chosen and summoned from the legions, had eyes only for him. They were delighted with him. They wanted him. They were making their prayers for him." So Constantine, the chosen, you know, this sort of like idea, you know, they're all gazing at the young man there. But, you know, there was a surprise awaiting. Lactantius goes on to say, you know, there was tremendous excitement on all sides as to what he was going to tell them. Then suddenly he proclaimed Severus and Maximinus as Caesars. Everyone was thunderstruck. Constantine was standing up on the platform, and people hesitated, wondering whether his name had been changed. But then, in view of everyone, Galerius stretched his hand back and drew out Maximinus Daza from behind him, pushing Constantine away. When Daza had taken off his private attire, Galerius brought him into the center of the platform. Everyone wondered who he was and where he had come from, but no one dared shout any objection amid the general consternation, this new and unexpected development.
Yeah, no one likes being looked over for a promotion.
Yes. Always think of this as like, you know, the Oscars, when like this is the cameras on all the people. And you know, there's a camera on Constantine. It's not him, but he still has to clap politely. Oh, yes, well done, you know.
He does. He does have to clap politely.
You know, meanwhile, Maximinus Daza goes up and, you know, gets the prize. But, you know, of course, Constantine is going to become the first Christian emperor. Lactantius is invested in him. But also, it's become quite a shock, you know, if no one knew who Maximinus Daza was. He is the nephew of Galerius. He is a military officer. And Lactantius is trying to paint him as sort of like this irrelevant nobody.
Yeah, that's a bit of a hard land, that one is, yeah.
Yes. And then Lactantius, you know, really sticks the boot into Daza and says, "But Daza, who had only recently been picked up from looking after cattle in the forests, had then at once become a guardsman, then an officer of the guard, soon afterwards a tribune, and the next day a Caesar. And then he now received the East to crush and trample underfoot, as might be expected of one who knew nothing about public or military affairs, a shepherd who was now to look after soldiers instead of cattle."
That's a very disparaging kind of summary of a career.
Well, you know, it's like Lactantius likes to play on the fact that, you know, the Tetrarch, they're all from the Danubian region. He's portraying them as rustic bumpkins, backwards and pagans, and you know how he calls Diocletian Diocles, etc. He wastes no opportunity to portray them like this, even though Constantine's glorious father is from exactly the same background.
And meanwhile, in the West, does Severus get elevated without incident?
We presume, we don't know. We have no account of it. It happens. So we now have a new imperial college, which is the Augusti, Constantius and Galerius, and the Caesars, who are Severus and Maximinus Daza. But there is a bit of a twist in the tale here. So long we're accustomed to thinking this is of Diocletian's retirement. And we'll talk more in a moment about where he goes and what he does. But as far as the official rhetoric of the state goes, Diocletian and Maximian get a new position. So we know from inscriptions from 305-306 that Diocletian and Maximian get the title of Senior Augustus, so Senior Augustus. We have inscriptions with six members of the Imperial College. You have Diocletian Maximian Seniores Augusti, so the Elder Augusti, or perhaps Emeriti, like the Pope Emeritus we had. Then you have the Augusti, and then you have the Nobilissimi Caesares, so, you know, the most noble Caesars. So yes, Diocletian does seem to give up ruling power, but he's still very much, in many ways, the father figure of this imperial college. And for him to be, you know, still included in imperial titles is really telling. And when Galerius builds his own palace at Gamzograd in Serbia, we have carvings of pairs of tetrarchs. There's carvings of pairs on like a standard. And there are three pairs, which includes Diocletian Maximian as the Emeriti. So, yes, he goes off from Nicomedia to his native land and retires in one sense, but in another sense, he's still very much present and remembered in this, you know, emeritus emperor position.
Yeah, I can believe that. I mean, this is uncharted territory for Rome to have retired emperors, let alone two of them. And for somebody like Galerius, it'd probably be important in some ways to show that he's got the endorsement of the prior administration.
Yes.
I guess. So include them if you got them. Yeah.
And it's like the same way that Pope Benedict, didn't he? He retired and became Pope Emeritus. And, you know, he still lived in the Vatican.
Awkward.
Yeah, exactly. At least Diocletian had the good grace to go to a lovely retirement villa.
To clarify, though, Constantius is the senior out of the two Augusti, isn't he?
Yes. So of the two ruling Augusti, Constantius's name always comes before Galerius.
Interesting. Okay. For all the shots that he's been credited with calling in this succession, Galerius was still the junior of the two. It makes me wonder if, you know, this succession was the plan all along and it's just been butchered in the retelling.
This is a problem, you know, when things happen behind closed doors. No one really knows what's going on when, you know, two people are in a room. And so often stories then circulate, as I talk about in my new book. Sorry, Matt.
Oh, good. Oh, good. All right. So what does retirement look like for Diocletian then?
Well, he was born at Salona, which is modern-day Croatia, just outside modern-day Split. And Split, actually, the central core, is built into Diocletian's retirement villa. So it's really amazing, this huge villa. So it's not just, you know, Diocletian doesn't go to a nice, you know, small cottage or something like that. You know, this is a massive walled complex built like a military camp, you know. It has temples in it, large baths, you know, plenty of servants' quarters, slaves and slaves' quarters, etc. But, you know, he retires there on the Adriatic, and it's well worth a visit today. I know there's a separate Wed in Rome episode, isn't there, on the palace.
But, yes.
If you go to Split, you know, many of the hotels you can stay at are inside the walls of the old palace, you know, where the entire city has been built in, and, you know, where we stayed, you know, you go downstairs and you could see, you know, the old Roman masonry and everything like that. So it's...
Oh, sounds amazing.
It's a great place to go. So Diocletian's there. Maximian retires to a villa in Italy, either in Campania or Lucania. We don't know exactly where.
We know less about Maximian's retirement plans, but we do get one little bit of color text, I think, that Diocletian doesn't seem to be in a rush to get involved in things again.
Yeah, there is this really wonderful anecdote, and this is in the Epitome de Casaribus, that Constantius and Galerius ask him to come out of retirement. And Diocletian replies, "If you could see at Salona the cabbages raised by our hands, you would surely never judge that a temptation." So, you know, he's much happier attending his cabbage patch than, you know, returning to the cut and thrust of imperial politics. But, and, you know, spoiler alert, he has to. He has to come out because the remaining tetrarchs make such a mess of things, including Maximian, who makes a real mess of things. Diocletian has to come out of retirement to sort things out. And so it's really not the end yet of his story.
That was Professor Calen Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. We are a listener-supported podcast, so thanks to everyone who has chipped in on Patreon. This podcast was recorded and produced in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.